Did anyone over the holiday give or receive a gift that required a manual? Yes? If you don't mind sharing, what was the thing? A drawing tablet? Okay. You got a guitar stand. Okay.
You're not going to believe this. But it was an electric salt and pepper grinder.
You do need a manual for that.
I had to be told it was.
It's very fresh salt. It's very nice. Okay, so after you put together your guitar stand, did you keep the manual or did you throw it away? Okay, salt and pepper shaker.
Always, I keep every
manual. You keep every manual, okay. What?
I have manuals for things I don't know where
are. I know, I have a drawer full of manuals. Anyone else keep or throw away? Who has their refrigerator manual? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I've got one from like a light fixture, and it's just like, turn it on, right? Like, it's already installed. It's already good to go. I don't need that manual anymore. But part of me, every time I'm cleaning out that junk drawer, is like, maybe I'm going to need this refrigerator manual. Maybe I'm going to need this stove manual. But they just sit in that drawer because we've done the thing. We've put the thing together. Sort of. The salt and pepper shaker is only partway assembled. So this year, we had to decide where we wanted to put our emphasis. And I think that really, it's really important for us to kind of get a grasp on what it is that we're holding here. And I think that a lot of us feel uncomfortable just kind of like reading any portion of this by ourselves. It feels very complicated. But it's a little bit different than a manual, right? But sometimes we treat it that way, where it's like, okay, I know the story of the Good Samaritan. I know that one. I don't need to read it anymore. Or let's see, what else? Sermon on the Mount. I've read that before. Mm-hmm. I know the story of Noah. So if you've read it like a manual, you just put it aside and you're like, I know that. I know how that works. And it's only occasionally when you're like, oh, I don't quite remember, or I'm having a hard time figuring out how to work my salt and pepper shaker, that you open up back up again. So this series, Free Little Library, it's all based on the idea that the Bible is not a manual, though you may have heard it said that it is. The Bible is meditation literature. Have you ever heard the phrase meditation literature?
Nope.
Yeah. It's because that's not something that's very, very common to us. But here's a good example. So say in the manual, you figure out how to put your guitar stand together, and then you throw that away, right? It's done. But if the guitar stand manual is unclear and causes you to get in an argument with the person that's helping you put it together, it's a bad manual, right? It's not well written. You would never think that it's your fault that the manual is unclear, right? But think about things that are written in the Bible. The phrase, love your neighbor as yourself. It's not as clear as put part A joining with part B, right? It leads us into asking more questions. That's like, well, what is love? Who is my neighbor? What does it mean if I don't love myself that well? How am I supposed to love my neighbor then? All of these questions and ambiguities are very intentional. You see, black and white stories are really good for teaching children how to see what's good and what's bad, but they're not very good at communicating to adults the actual complexities of the world around us. And what we have here is a very masterfully written art, piece of art and literature that is written in the style of meditation literature. And the purpose of it is that as we read these things over and over and over again, and as they cause discussions between us, we begin to change.
Amen.
Hopefully, you were not changed much by the putting together of your guitar stand. The salt and pepper thing sounds traumatic for Sharon, so she may be slightly changed, but that's not the point of the Bible. The point of the Bible is not that we know more. It's that we become more wise.
Amen.
We're not trying to solve all of the formulaic issues of the world. We're trying to be able to see how to deal with things that don't have clear answers, to understand ourselves a little bit better. What's really interesting to think is that on the year 1000 BC, that is a very long time ago, Psalm 1 was written. And Psalm 1, 2 says, "I will meditate on your words day and night." That is describing how this was intended to be read. Jesus also, the Old Testament, they would memorize large portions of the Hebrew Bible. And if you've memorized it, why would you ever talk about it again? But they would talk about these things over and over and over again and discuss and debate. Jesus is in the temple talking to the teachers of the law. It's because he had an idea and they had an idea, and they were communicating back and forth about what those things were and how they best applied to the world right now. Isn't that fascinating to think that this way of reading the Bible has been practiced by generations upon generations and generations of people, and that we have the opportunity to join them in that exercise? And any time during this sermon that you hear me say read, I would like you to also think listen, right? There are so many ways that you can listen to the Bible, and that is just as good as reading. Many of the people who were the first hearers of the scriptures were not literate, and that is why they memorized it, is so that they could recite it to themselves and recite it to others. So there are apps.
I love Lectio 365 and Pray As You Go. My two favorite devotional apps. It's mostly scripture.
Yeah. So it's a really good way to just kind of absorb large chunks of the story without having to like sit down and dedicate an hour. I'm not a very good reader. Like I get tired immediately when I start trying to like read words on a page, especially if they're small. But what helps me a lot is I'll turn it on and listen to it, and I might be like going about my day doing chores, or I may like follow along in the text. So one good source that we reference a lot is the Bible Project, and Tim Mackey is the I don't know what you call producer of that. Leader of that, but this is how he describes it. The purpose of the Bible is to be read aloud to God's assembled people, to both tell the story that reminds them who they are, and also to invite those assembled people into this covenant relationship with God, not just so that they know God, but that so they may be transformed by this relationship and become God's representations to the nations. So there's some aspect of reading this text aloud that is intended to change us and change the way that we interact with the world. So this series, that's a lot, this series is all about just trying to like make you feel a little bit more comfortable if you open up the Bible and you're like, what am I reading? So we're going to go through a couple different like types of writing that are in the Bible and the way that the original readers would have known to read those things. So we have genres. We're very familiar with that idea, whether it's books or series or TV or movies. There are different genres of movies. So let's just go through a few of our kind of like modern genres that we know change how we should approach that thing, right? What about satire or a comedian, right? So when we know that something is satire, when it's humorous, we know that we're going to be approaching that a little bit differently. Have you ever been listening to a comedian and you find yourself laughing and saying, that is so true, right? You're just like, ah, that is so true. But actually, it's not true. It is like grossly exaggerated. But some part of it is ringing true because it's bringing attention to something you were not paying attention to before. I love that about comedy. It's supposed to like bring us into awareness of these things that are kind of on the peripheral. And some things in the Bible are written in a very humorous, dramatic way to make you laugh and to make you think, oh, that is totally different than I thought it was. We're going to see a little bit of that in our story today. So this is a little bit complicated, but we're getting a little bit into the nitty-gritty. If you don't remember these things, that's going to be okay. I'll give you a few key points at the end. Okay, so another type of genre is a biography. So when we're reading a biography, there are a few things that we know going in, right? That it's, in general, going to try to be accurate. The intention is to describe this person's life. And it may be written by someone who's a super fan of them, or maybe someone who's a little neutral, or someone who's not quite a super fan, you know? And we know that those things influence like how we read a biography. All right, what about a drama? We watch something that's a drama or read something that is a drama. We know that it is overly dramatic, overly emotional. And the intention of that is to draw your emotions in, to ride the roller coaster with them, right? We're familiar with these things. All right, this one. I love this. When you see that at the beginning or the end of a movie, what does that do? For me, that sends me on this like huge Google search, right? Of like, what parts of this crazy story are true? And sometimes it's like, oh, we just used the girl's name, right? Or those reenactments that say in the bottom, this is a dramatization. I think those are hilarious. Yeah, so all of these, when we see these types of genres, we know going in how to approach that type of literature and how we should incorporate it into our body of knowledge, right? But we're not as familiar with the types of literature that are used in the Bible. So this series is just about giving us a few helpful tips on like how to approach those things. And this is the main thing to remember. God can handle our mistakes. So like I said, that this is not about knowing all the correct facts and learning all of the things. This type of literature is intended to make us understand the things that we don't know, right? Like there are things that we don't know, and that is the purpose of it, right? So every time that we read and reread, we may see things in a different way, but we're never going to get to the point where we know all of the things. And that inherently means that we're going to make mistakes, or we're going to realize that in the past we made mistakes, right? And that's just part of the process. Okay, so here's a couple of types of writings. So this is how we're going to break this up. We're going to talk about narrative, which is basically the stories that are in the Bible. And then we're going to talk about poetry, which is pretty, a lot of different things. And then the word prose is just kind of a fancy word to say like laws, essays, and letters, right? It's not a story. It's not a poem, but it's like written to someone for a specific intent to kind of like make an argument for something or prove a point. But did you know that over 40% of the Bible is stories? And so it's pretty important for us to kind of understand how to read these stories and what these stories are intended to do. We're going to break this up. Today we're going to be talking about the stories in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible stories. And next week Marquette's going to be talking about the New Testament stories. Because the way we approach a story like the story of Abraham and Isaac is different than the way we approach a parable of Jesus. So we're going to break those two things up. And today, my task is to just talk a little bit about Hebrew Bible stories. So these are the ones that a lot of us are familiar with, the story of the flood, the story of Abraham and Isaac, like I said, and Isaac almost being sacrificed. Let's see what else. So many. I'm drawing a blank on all the Bible stories.
Burning bush.
Yeah. All of these. Okay. These are really great. Okay, so unfortunately, when I was taught about the Bible, I was taught that there were 66 books in the Bible, right? But I was taught that like Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy were kind of like the one type of genre, and that Psalms and Proverbs were another type of genre, and that the prophets were another type of genre. But unfortunately, that's not true at all. Because you'll see that like Moses crosses the Red Sea and then he breaks out into song, right? And the prophets do this too. They'll be kind of like, hey, I was walking along, and then they'll be like, and a voice of God came down, and then they'll like break into this huge poem. So the genres are not as clear cut as like, okay, this book is one thing, this book is another thing, this book is another thing. But there are a few like simple ways to tell what you're reading. And so here are the basic characteristics of a story. There's a setting where it happened. There are characters. And this is an important one. There is a plot. So there are characters. So let's see, Gideon is in this certain city and he sets out to do this thing. Setting, character, plot. And that's a little bit different from poetry, because you'll know you're reading a poem when it's, like I said, this fantastic language. It's exaggeration and comparison, like
the trees clapped their hands,
or my soul was like a deer, right? Like there's these comparisons that are very imaginative. A lot of times when prophets are declaring the words of God, they're speaking in poems, because it's sometimes poetry is able to help us kind of picture the things that we can't actually describe. So that's how you know if you're reading a poem versus reading a story. All right, so the difference between narrative and prose is there's not typically a narrator when you're reading prose. So think about like the letters of Paul. He's not saying, and then Paul said, right? There's no narrator in letters. It's you're just like talking directly to the person. They offer logical arguments, and they typically don't have a plot, like genealogies, right? Or a list of laws. They may have characters, but they don't have a plot. All of this is what we're going to be talking about in the next like 4 or 5 weeks. So this is just helping us understand today, and you don't have to know all of this today. All right. I'm just trying to narrow down what I actually have to talk about, because big task. The cards that I gave you, so for every sermon series this year, we have decided that we're going to do a little memory verse. And I will give you candy. Yes, I will. Sure, I will give you candy. Just let me know in advance so I can have some. So every series this year is going to have a little card like that that you can put wherever you see it often. As just a way for by the end of the year, we have accumulated a handful of these verses from Scripture that can encourage us and that will come to mind, like while we're doing different things. So this one from Romans is all about how the Scriptures written of old are meant for our encouragement. All right, so you can keep that, put it where you want. If you memorize it, I will give you candy per Mary Hoyt. All right, so back to our Hebrew stories. Okay, so when we're talking about these stories that are in the Old Testament, unfortunately, an aspect of this ancient Hebrew meditation narrative is that they're intentionally leaving out a lot of details. And that's not something we are accustomed to with novels, right? You are painted the whole picture and you're given the backstory. But with these Hebrew meditation narratives, they leave out a lot of those details because they want you to ask questions. So, for example, in the Garden of Eden, where did the snake come from? I don't know. They don't say, right? But that is meant for us to contemplate by ourselves and with each other. What could that mean? Where does that snake come from? It also doesn't really tell us their motives a lot of the time. It just kind of says what they do. And then we get to discuss what were the motives. Another interesting one is like the plagues of Egypt. All these really weird things, like all of these frogs and these locusts. Like, that's so random, and it doesn't say why those things were chosen. So there are all of these details that are added in and a lot that are left out intentionally to point us towards, I wonder what that means. As I said, the black and white stories are really good for children, but this is intended to be talked about among adults. And so that's part of being a good reader of the Bible, is being able to read it and ask questions to yourself and to your family, to others around you. Okay, another aspect is it teaches through repetition and subtle comparison and contrasts. Let's go back to thinking about the story of creation, where every single day God said it was good, 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 God said it was very good. And so that repetition is supposed to teach us something. And then that slight difference is also supposed to be like, well, what does that mean? Why is that very good? And why was everything else good? Right? So that's just an example of this type of writing. Okay, and this is a really important one, is that these stories, they're not standalone stories. And that's really frustrating because we want it to be all encapsulated. But the people who wrote the Bible are very intelligent, and they are building upon a large history of knowledge, of community knowledge. And so a lot of the stories reference each other. But also, like, there are so many stories of Abraham, and sometimes a story from the beginning informs a story that happened later. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like one of the parables of Jesus. You're not supposed to learn a specific lesson with every single story. Mm-hmm. It's more like themes that run throughout. That's why it takes just like reading and reading, and then things just like come to light or pop out at you in a different way. Okay, now we're going to do story time. All right, Judges 6:36 through 40. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece, and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said." And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Do not be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. But this time, let the fleece be dry and make the ground covered with dew." That night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry, and all the ground was covered with dew. Okay, so this is a good example of these stories are not isolated events. If we were just to take this one little scene from Gideon's life and try to learn a lesson from it,
as often happens,
some of the lessons that we might try to learn from this is, how in the world am I supposed to test God to know what to do? Mm-hmm. Another thing that I thought we could probably learn is, if you're going to test God, make sure you do it 2 times and make sure they're complete opposites. That way it's scientifically accurate, right? So if we're just taking this for just this passage, right, we're not seeing the whole story. And I chose the story of Gideon because it's only 2 chapters long. And it felt like a reasonable thing that we could, like, kind of look at as a practice. So I'm going to sit and I'm going to read you the story of Gideon. And let's try and keep in mind, just like, what are some things that pop out to you as things that repeat, or words that repeat, or just like, who is the character of Gideon and what are the things that commonly pop up for him? All right. You can close your eyes if you want to. Don't get bogged down with the weird names of places. It doesn't matter right now. The Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. The hand of Midian prevailed over Israel. Because of Midian, the Israelites provided for themselves hiding places in the mountains, caves, and strongholds. For wherever the Israelites planted seed, the Midianites and the people of the east would come up against them. They would encamp against them and destroy all the produce of the land, as far as the neighborhood of Gaza. And they would leave no sustenance in Israel, nor any sheep or ox or donkey. They and their livestock would come up, and they would even bring their tents as thick as locusts. Neither they nor their camels could be counted, so they wasted the land as they came in. Thus, Israel was greatly impoverished because of Midian, and the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help. All right, so we've got our bad guy. When the Israelites cried to the Lord on account of the Midianites, the Lord sent a prophet to the Israelites, and he said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I led you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of slavery. And I led you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not pay reverence to the gods of the Amorites, whose land you live. But you have not given heed to my voice." Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak, which belonged to Joash. And his son Gideon was beating out the wheat in the winepress. So typically, wheat is beaten out on a threshing floor, which is a very large, open, kind of like concrete area. It's like a stone, and it's very flat. But he is beating it in a wine press, which is a very small, tall area. So he's like hiding in the wine press because they've been taking all of their wheat and all of their crops. So Gideon is beating out the wheat in the winepress to hide from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, you valiant warrior." Gideon answered him, "But sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all of this happened to us?" It's a good question. "And where are his wonderful deeds that our ancestors recounted to us? Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But the Lord has cast us off and given us into the hand of Midian." Then the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. I hereby commission you."
Thanks.
Yeah. He responded, "But sir, how can I deliver Israel? My family is the weakest, and I am the smallest of my family." And the Lord said to him, "But I will be with you, and you shall strike down the Midianites, every one of them." Then he said to him, "Now if I have found favor with you, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me, and do not depart from here until I come to you and bring you out my present and set it before you." And the angel said, "I will stay until you return." So Gideon went into his house and prepared a goat and some cakes and with some flour. And he put the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot, and he brought it to him under the oak and presented them. And the angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened cakes and put them on the rock and pour the broth over it." And so he did. And then the angel of the Lord reached out the tip of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened cakes. And a fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. Then Gideon perceived that it was an angel of the Lord. And Gideon said, "Help me, Lord God, for I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace be to you. Do not fear. You shall not die." And Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it, "The Lord is Peace." That night, the Lord said to him, "Take your father's bull and a second bull and pull down the altar of Baal that belongs to your father and cut down the sacred pole that is beside it and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold here in proper order. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the sacred pole that you've cut down." So take down your father's monument and burn it, and set up a new monument to this God. So Gideon took his 10 servants and did as the Lord had told him. But because he was too afraid of his family and the townspeople to do it by day, he did it by night. Then the townspeople rose early in the morning, and the altar of Baal was broken down, and the sacred pole beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar that had been built. And they said to one another, "Who has done this?" After searching and inquiring, they were told, "Gideon, son of Joash, did." Then the townspeople said to Joash, "Bring out your son so that he may die, for he pulled down the altar of Baal and cut down the sacred pole beside it." Joash said to all those who were arrayed against him, "Will you contend for Baal, or will you defend his cause? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is God, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been pulled down." Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Jerubbabel. So he got a name change. And that is to say, "Let Baal contend against himself," because he pulled the altar down. All right, we're getting to the fleece part now. So all the Midianites and the people of the east came together, and they crossed over, and they encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet. And the Abirizites, I don't know, were called to follow him. Okay, so they're allies. They came to follow him. And they sent out messengers throughout all Manasseh, and they too were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, and they all met to follow him. So these are all just like different families, large families. They all went to meet them. Then Gideon said to God, this is the part we read, in order to see that you will deliver Israel from my hand, as you have said, I'm going to place a fleece on the threshing floor, and if there is dew on the fleece alone, and it is dry on the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel by my hand, as you have said. And it was so. So when he rose early the next day and squeezed the fleece, he wrung enough dew from the fleece to fill the bowl of water. Then Gideon said to God, do not let your anger burn against me, but speak to me one more time. Let me please make the trial of the fleece just one more time. Let it be dry only on the fleece, and on the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, and on the ground there was dew. Then Gideon and all his troops who were with him rose early and encamped around the spring of Herod, and the camp of Midian was north of them below. The Lord said to Gideon, the troops who are with you are far too many, for Israel would take credit away from me, saying, my own hand has delivered me. Now therefore, proclaim this to the hearing of the troops. Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home. At this point, I was thinking that Gideon was going to go home. So Gideon sifted them out, and 22,000 returned home, and 10,000 remained. So it's two-thirds. It's not good. Then the Lord said to Gideon, the troops are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them out for you there. You guys, you remember the story? Take them down to the water? All right, so I shall say, this one will go with you, and he shall go with you, and this one will not go with you, and then he shall not go with you. So he brought the troops down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, all those who lap water with their tongue as dogs lap, you shall put to one side, and those who kneel down to drink, and putting their hand to their mouths, you shall put to the other side. The number of those who lapped was 300, and the rest of the troops knelt down to drink the water. Then the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 who lapped, I will deliver you and give you the Midians into your hand. So the ones that like put their face all the way down into the water, those are the ones that you want. So the people took their provisions in their hand and their trumpets, and he sent all of the rest of Israel back to their own tents. But the 300 remained. That same night, We're getting to the end here. That same night, the Lord said to him, get up and attack the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you fear to attack, go down to the camp with your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterwards you will be strengthened to attack the camp. Then he went down with his servant to the outposts of the armed men who were there. The Midianites and Amalekites and all the people of the east along the valley were as thick as locusts, and their camels were outnumbered, countless as the sands on the seashore. When Gideon arrived, there was a man telling a dream to his comrade. He said, I had a dream, and in it, a cake of barley bread tumbled down a hill into the camp of Midian and came to a tent and struck it down, so it fell, and it turned upside down, and the tent collapsed. And his comrade answered, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has given Midian and all the army. When Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped, and he returned to camp and said, get up, for the Lord has given the army of Midian into your hand. And after he divided the 300 men into three groups and put trumpets in their hands, and empty jars with torches inside the jars. He said to them, look at me and do the same. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets around the whole camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. And when they had just set the watch, they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hand. So the three companies blew the trumpets, broke the jars, holding on to their left hand and the torches in their right hands, and blew the trumpets and cried, "For the sword of the Lord and for Gideon." And every man stood in his place all around the camp, and all the men in the camp ran, they cried out, and fled. And then there's several verses that just goes on to name that there's like chaos and everybody's like fighting each other. But they won. Okay, I'm skipping down a few. Then there was another family that came and said to him, "What have you done to us that you did not call us to fight against Midian?" And he said to them, "What have I done in comparison to you? You are so great. Is not the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abizar? God has given into your hand the camps of Midian. What have I been able to do in comparison to you?" And their anger against him subsided. Okay, so I'm just going to paraphrase the last few paragraphs here. So then Gideon goes on to the other outposts of these towns. And as he goes, his army is hungry. And he comes to some Israelites and he's like, "Can you give us bread?" And they were like, "No, we don't like you." And he's like, "Well, when I finish what I'm doing here, I'm going to come back and get you." And then so he goes and defeats some people and he comes back and he kills all the men of that city, of the Israelite city. And then the Israelites said to Gideon, the ones that were left, "Rule over us. Rule over us, you and your sons and your grandsons, for you have delivered us out of the hands of Midian." And Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Then Gideon said to them, "Let me make a request. Each of you give me an earring that he has taken from the spoil. And we will willingly give them to you," they answered. So they spread a garment, and each of them threw an earring he had taken from the spoil. And the weight of the gold earrings that he had requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. And Gideon made an ephod, made a little statue out of it, and he put it in his town. And all the Israelites prostituted themselves to it there. And it became a snare for Gideon and his family. So Midian was subdued before the Israelites, and they lifted up their heads no more. So the land had rest for 40 years. But Gideon, son of Joash, went to live in his own house. Gideon and his 70 sons and their offspring. It goes on to name them. Yes. As soon as Gideon died, the Israelites relapsed and prostituted themselves to the Baal, making Baal-berith their god. And the Israelites did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hand of their enemies on every side. And they did not exhibit loyalty to the house of Gideon in return for all of the good that he had done to Israel. What a good story. So, one thing that we see from the story of Gideon is that when we're looking at this incident of the fleece, that was actually like the fourth or fifth sign that Gideon had received. What I think is so funny at the beginning of the story of Israel is when we first see Gideon, he's threshing wheat in a wine press, which is very, like, he's hiding, right? And then this angel comes to him and says almost comically, "Hey, you man of valor." Yeah. And then repeatedly throughout the whole story, it's referencing that Gideon is afraid and those who are with him are afraid. And over and over and over again, there's this theme of fear. And so when we get to the story of the fleece, when we read it in context, it's more of like, when is this guy finally going to trust God? Instead of this idea of, well, how do I know what God really wants, right? It's like, when are you going to stop being afraid? It's more of the story that Gideon is seeing. Another thing that we see as a repetition in the story of Gideon is this idea of these altars. And so at the beginning, Gideon was told to tear one down. And at the end, he built one, mm-hmm. right? And at the very beginning of the story, we see that the Israelites were doing what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And at the end, it's the people were doing evil in the sight of the Lord. So you also were talking about how they say that, remember, God is the one who saved you from the Egyptians who were your oppressors. And now you have these Midianite oppressors. And Gideon asks this great question where he says, if God is really with us, then why are all these things happening? Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, and then the angel doesn't answer that at all, right? But at the end, you see that God did deliver them, and they went right back to what they had been doing before, right? So it's almost in reaction to that question that Gideon is asking, like, why are these things happening? And God's like, I've repeatedly been delivering you, and you're not listening, remembering, paying attention. Other thing I think is hilarious is that the voice of the Lord said, I want to whittle down the troops so that you guys don't take credit for this. And then as they run into battle, they say, for the Lord and for Gideon. You know? It's just so funny, right? And so obviously these are not all of the things that we can learn from this story. But what I'm trying to show is there are really interesting things to take away as we read things out loud in big chunks together. It's a really dense story that we may not see all the things the very first time that we read it. And that is intentional, right? It's meant for us to be like, well, what did that say? Because you wouldn't realize that, oh, man of valor is a joke unless you already knew the end of the story, mm-hmm. right? So it's meant to kind of be read cyclically. All right, so that was just an example. But I want to leave you guys with a few actual helpful things that we can do when we approach these stories. It's just simply to meditate on it. Just spend some time listening to it and just get to know the story. Just spend more time listening to the story. Another one, I want to let you off the hook here. Don't try to learn something every time. It's not a parable. You don't really know if you're reading the whole story when you're sitting down to read a chunk, right? So don't try and learn something every single time that you sit down. Just absorb the story. Use it more as a time to just like get more information and gain more reflection. Pay attention to characters. So often characters, they have the same problems in the Bible over and over and over again. Kind of like Gideon, he's always afraid. So when you pay attention to characters, you'll kind of learn some themes that are going on. And like we mentioned, pay attention to repetitions, because that's one of the ways that these stories are trying to teach us. Anything that doesn't make sense, just make it move you to ask questions, even if you don't have answers, right? That's part of the meditation is, I wonder. And you could even write it down. You could talk to somebody else about it. And it's not that we're going to find the answers to these things, but in the process of taking this in and thinking about it, it should be changing the way that we see ourselves in the world. Kind of like with Gideon's story, how the beginning and the end were so similar, but the middle, God did something really cool, right? That how often we do that in our own lives, right? That we feel like we're in the same place that we always were, and it's because we're forgetting that part that happened in the middle. Yeah. They also made those out of earrings, I think. Okay, so another thing I want to say is just accept that it's not all going to make sense. That is by design, but it's also because of the passing of time and our translations. So some of this stuff is written like alliteratively that literally doesn't translate. So we have really good translations, but you're never going to understand all of the things that are happening unless you were to like learn ancient Hebrew, and then also transport yourself back to that time. There are just things that, like, we take for granted that they all knew as, like, cultural knowledge. And that's okay. It's okay. The last thing that I think is actually the most important thing to remember when we're reading these Old Testament stories is that throughout all of these stories, it's hard to figure out who the bad guy is and who the good guy is. Like, consider David, right? Like, he's held up as this, like, really great person in the Bible, but he makes so many messed up choices. And so a theme that you'll see in these stories as you read is that these characters are really complex, and that the main character is actually God interacting with all of these, like, lesser characters, and that God is actually the hero of the story. We hear a lot that, like, how can God be, like, condoning or working with all of these really messed up people, right? Like, but, like, what other option is there? And so one of the main lessons that we can learn from studying the Bible is that, like, we are those people, and that God is continually willing to work with us and, like, also shake God's head at the choices that we make. All right, last major spoiler. For the whole Old Testament stories, the major thrust or emphasis of these stories is to remind the reader to acknowledge and trust God. Mm-hmm. Each story shows the failures of those who don't acknowledge and trust God, and shows the blessings of those who do acknowledge and trust God. So, for example, David is a really good example. The reason that David is held up as a hero in the Bible is not because David did all the right things, but it's because David was consistently coming back and acknowledging God and God's overarching influence in the story and putting his final trust in God. And so you can see that the intention of these biblical authors is to show these stories and highlight for us that we should be learning how to see God and acknowledge God and remember God and trust God. And though while we can't always take a moral lesson from each of the characters, we can see how God is interacting with that character. Make sense? I've really enjoyed the story time with you guys.